From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
When you do have a situation of a crowd throwing rocks and the National Guard is called in, that there is always the chance that it will escalate into the kind of a tragedy that happened at Kent State.
That was then President Richard Nixon in May of 1970, shortly after four students were killed by the Ohio National Guard at Kent State. The students were protesting the announcement by Nixon of an escalation of the Vietnam War.
And if there's one thing I am personally committed to, it's this. I saw the pictures of those four youngsters in the Evening Star the day after that tragedy. And I vowed then that we were going to find methods that would be more effective to deal with these problems of violence, methods that would deal with those who would use force and violence and endanger others, but at the same time would not take the lives of innocent people.
Despite that vow by President Nixon, less than 2 weeks later, two more students were killed at Jackson State in Mississippi. Thursday marks the 47th anniversary of the killings at Kent State, and there's a commemoration ceremony being held there. We caught up with two people on their way to attend. One is the sister of Allison Krause, who was one of the four students killed. Her name is Laurel Krause, and she runs the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We also spoke with Green Party activist and journalist Pat LaMarche. So, let's see, Laurel, let's start with this. What are you guys doing? You're on the road. Where are you? You're in Pennsylvania somewhere?
Yeah, we're in the middle of Pennsylvania right now, soon to leave. And I think it's about a four-hour drive to Kent. Yeah. And I'm going to be going back because, you know, my sister Allison Krause was killed there 47 years ago. And three other students and protesters were killed that day as well. Sandra Scheuer, Bill Schroeder, and Jeff Miller. Nine were wounded. It was a Vietnam protest against the war. The state called out the militia, the National Guard. It started happening as a response to President Nixon saying that he was going to extend and start fighting a war in Cambodia, which they had been bombing for over a year, and they needed to expose and they needed to make sure that, you know, it was out because it was coming out in the news. Right. So basically, the students across America revolted. And there was a draft going on. They had to go fight that war. It wasn't a choice. They couldn't even vote for it because the voting age was 21 at that time. And it's my feeling that the government chose where they wanted to make a statement. And Kent State and Jackson State were the places they wanted to make that statement. If you protest against the government, you can get killed.
Yeah, there was some evidence that came out afterwards that was pretty much the intent of the Nixon administration, of the president himself and the people around him, that they wanted to telegraph this message home. And it took you a very long while and people who were investigating these things outside of the government, a very long while to unearth some evidence that really wasn't possible to unearth until digital tools like digital sound processing came around, found out and proved that there was an order to fire on the students that day from the National Guard.
Yes, and it was denied for over 40 years by all facets of the government. There was never an order. It never made any sense because when the guardsmen went up the hill, they went to the highest point on the land. It's my feeling that this was the domestic battle of the Vietnam War. Two of them, Kent State, Jackson State. And when they went up the hill, all the guardsmen walked away from the students, marched away up to the top of the hill. And then they all turned in unison, and then they all shot in unison. And when they were shooting at unarmed students. By the way, they were wearing war gear, you know, helmets, you know, gas masks, M1s. when they turned shoot and fired at the students were unarmed. It was lunchtime. They were changing classes. Some were protesting, and it was on the commons.
Yeah, it was outside another on a college, college campus. Lunchtime, people are going from building to building, class to class, the cafeteria, etc. Some protesting. The army is there. They climb to the highest point, turn around, and start shooting after someone yells, fire.
Yeah, well, it's not as if they could have the same thought at the same time, as my mother said. They were given an order, and they all turned in unison, and they all shot in unison. You can only accomplish that with an order. But we'd never had the proof until Stuart Allen, forensic expert, digitally analyzed the tape for the first time in 2010. And his findings were verified. He also unearthed just before that order, four low-caliber pistol shots. And those were actually the first shots fired at Kent State. And it's alleged that an FBI informant provocateur, Terry Norman, who was also a student at Kent State, but he was wearing his sports jacket and gas mask, and he had his camera and a little pistol in his pocket, in a holster. And he then created what we believe to be the sound of sniper fire so that the guard could then react.
Right. It was, 44 years later that you finally got this in front of the United Nations, and had the U.S. government there, appearing, someone from the Department of Justice appearing on behalf of the U.S. government in front of the U.N. Human Rights, what is it, the Human Rights Council, the Human Rights, one of the Human Rights Organizations, Mission, yeah.
Committee.
Human Rights Committee. And at that point in time, with the evidence that had been presented, they essentially had to admit that this was the first time in 44 years that they admitted that, in fact, those four killings were murder.
Yeah, no one really gets the government to admit murder. It's definitely one of the high points that we've had related to the work that we've done at the Kent State Truth Tribunal. And they said it was murder and killing. They said it in front of the United Nations. But there was never any news about that. And so when the government Pat LaMarsh, why don't you chime in, please?
I wrote a story about it. I have a page at the Huffington Post. I wrote a story about it.
And you're going to be speaking at Kent State also, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really excited. I don't think I've ever been given a greater honor, and I owe Laurel for that. I've been following Laurel and her story and the work she's been doing to get the truth out for, 4 or 5 years now. Mm. And I've had a great opportunity. And one of the big things that happened this year is last fall, I think it was October, there was a hearing in front of the National Park Service as to whether or not Kent State should become a national landmark, which I didn't know until I was doing research for my speech tomorrow, that they actually tried to make it a national landmark in 1977. And it was completely, completely rejected. And that was one of the injunctions that the students were going for was, boy, if we could make this a national landmark or a National Park Service protected land, they couldn't build this gymnasium that they wanted to build there. And they did eventually build, because they don't, history is great if you can cover it up, right?
Right. This is one of the things that they do, is try to obliterate history.
Right. I'm right near Gettysburg. I live close to Gettysburg, and you go there and there are battlefields and they're covered with all kinds of monuments. And you take a look at Pickett's Charge and you don't really get the scope of a mile of men shoulder to shoulder walking into bullets and cannon fire, because son of a gun, but they let them put a Chinese buffet on Pickett's Charge, and as long as history gets covered up with other stuff, you don't understand the power and the, and I still didn't understand. One of the reasons I think that Kent State was used as a place to make a point by, and don't forget, it's J. Edgar Hoover. He was the guy in charge of the FBI. But this Kent State was an oasis. It was not. Wouldn't be like doing it at Boston College or NYU or Columbia or somewhere. It was an oasis. It was out in the middle of cow pastures. You literally could cut that town off by closing off two or three roads. I mean, if you were going to occupy territory and terrorize people, that was a perfect location because it was so isolated.
Right.
And then, since I've been doing research on Kent State and reporting on Kent State, I've learned that, the as soon as the shootings happened, the school evacuated. They brought in buses. They pulled the kids out of there. How do you get that many buses ready to roll? It was just really a whole pile of fascinating stuff. And I'm not really a big conspiracy theorist. I'm much more the Occam's razor. If there's a chance they're just stupid, greedy, or evil, then most stuff probably happens by accident under those three premises. But it really was the perfect storm place to have this happen. It wasn't like there were going to be a whole bunch of bystanders. When I was there in 3 years ago, too, I went downtown and I spoke with the woman who told me that her dad was at one of the halls, the VFW or AMVETS or something like that, getting drunk. And the National Guard went in and said, "Hey, who wants to help us lock down this city?" And pulled all these drunks out of the, out of the veterans halls and armed them and set them up at checkpoints.
Jesus.
I know. I mean, so the story just unravels and unravels and unravels. And it's like, wow, there was absolutely no concern for the fact that there were a whole pile of young people. And we know that's true because we were loading them on planes and ships and sending them to Vietnam.
Yeah.
U.S. young people just were not any kind of commodity but cannon fodder.
They were totally expendable.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and sadly, we've got the same sort of leadership again,
Right. And have had it almost since.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So it's 47 years, and some details have emerged after some furious digging by yourself, Laurel, and some others. But the government is still resisting. There's Attorney Michael Kuzma's FOIA action, for example, filed a year ago tomorrow on the 46th anniversary against the Department of Justice with respect to Terrence Brooke Norman, a.k.a. Terrence Norman, and the allegations of a gunshot that might have precipitated the order to fire and possible involvement with the FBI. You want to speak about that?
I think I referenced Terry Norman a little bit already. He was a very important cog in the wheel related to Kent State. He was just one of the actors, though. He needed to create the sound of sniper fire so that the guardsmen can then shoot at the students. And most of them were over a football field away when they were at the top of that hill. His gun was the first shot at Kent State. And there's real significance there. The problem is it was isolated by Stuart Allen, the forensic expert who did the digital analysis of the tape. And the government will absolutely refuses to acknowledge this. This guy's living in North Carolina, a carefree life. He's kind of a made man. No matter what he's done, he doesn't have to pay for it. He gets off because of what he did in his youth. And, here we are 47 years later. He's embezzled a lot of money. He had some false front companies. He got caught. I don't think he's ever gone to prison. There's not a picture of him ever entering prison. That's what happens. They always take a picture. What happened in January is 177 pages of FOIA documents were released from the FBI on Terry Norman. And it talks about that gun. And it talks about where he got that gun. He got it from an Akron policeman. They provided the gun to him. And we're digging through that right now and analyzing what is new, what is not new, and experts, thank goodness we have experts that can do this. But it was very shocking for us to get this FOIA release. And I was talking to Mike about that. I said, hey, you know, how did we get this released? How did they give, I mean, how did this happen that they finally reversed their position and gave us this, all this evidence and information? And he said, the young people that are fulfilling their FOIA requests, they don't know how controversial this information is. And they're releasing a lot of stuff right now because of that, because they just have no context on what it needs to be kept quiet and what can, you know, can be released. So it's pretty interesting that we've been able to benefit from that.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet they're opposing the effort to get the balance of the information vigorously. And that was the Obama administration and now the Trump administration. And presumably these are things that have been known for the entire 47 years. So we're talking about Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, right. Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And
you know, though, the Obama administration, they have they had a point to make to defend their own behavior. You know, I would think that anything the Obama administration did, denying information from the past, would just have something to do with persecuting Edward Snowden. You know, I think that that administration was no friend of civil rights and the truth and honesty. So, you know, I'm the one who thinks people are just sinister in the moment. And if anyone was CYA, and they were CYA and about all the stuff about Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, you know, and on and on and on with, you know, I was so concerned about the whole Chelsea Manning release because I was like, really, honestly, you can't just get her out of there before that jackass takes over. You know, you're going to leave it a possibility that he would abrogate law because, of course, he's going to if he feels like it. He's insane. You know, I mean, all of this stuff to just make it look like it's okay to keep the truth from the public, they had to just keep touting that party line in the Obama administration, I think.
I wrote a couple of letters with my mom, et cetera, to President Obama. He never responded to a thing. I mean, I never got anywhere with anyone there in the whole 8 years. And I, you know, I work on environmental issues too. It's just no response, no interest, go away, move on. And you know, one of the things that happened, though, 47 years ago when they shot at all those students and all the and everyone watched on television, they all got affected by it. Kent State happened to all of us. It wasn't just my family.
Right.
Everyone got hurt. And that hurt also hampered our ability to fight for ourselves.
Well, Laurel brought up an excellent point right now. And certainly I was out at the Dakota Access Pipeline last fall and wrote a story about it. But she was talking about the 75 years hanging over people's heads for protesting. 75 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I know.
This is so important. You know, this is so important that protesters are protected. You know, it blows my mind. It blows my mind.
So that's I just wrote an article about that. And it's an important article because it calls for the protection of protesters and so that they can't be killed, that they're not going to be exposed to excessive force, that there's not going to be wrongful arrest or even arrest. I mean, it's a First Amendment right. We're supposed to be able to sit there and dissent. We're supposed to assemble. We're supposed to be able to speak our minds and speak our truth. And it's absolutely, I mean, this J20 thing that just came out, which is, you know, the 200 people that were protesting the 200 people that got arrested at the inauguration in Washington, D.C., they're facing 75 years in jail right now.
I know. If you think about that.
I've been trying to get a hold of Paul Ryan for about 4 years because there's a piece of legislation pending that's important. And, you know, we've been talking to everybody except pretty – everyone will talk to us, but no, a lot of people don't vote for it. It's about homelessness. And Paul Ryan just won't even – he won't even let us email him because we don't come from the right zip code because we don't live in Janesville, Wisconsin. But he's the Speaker of the House. Every zip code matters to him or should.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was standing out in front of his office in Janesville, Wisconsin, last fall with a sign that said, "Will you help the homeless?" And his staff called the cops on me. I'm standing on a public street. I'm not even speaking. I'm just standing there with a piece of cardboard. Wow. And the cops came. They wanted my ID. I said, I haven't done anything for which you deserve my identification. You know, what's the probable cause? They went to the woman I was with in the van. She was in a van across the way. He wanted to go inside the van. She said, no. You know, I mean, you know, where's your search warrant? Mm. I was standing with a piece of cardboard.
And that's at the heart of Kent State. It's about protest. The right to protest without getting killed.
The right to even inquire. I mean, they don't even want a bunch of people gathering somewhere and asking a question about why are we doing it this way, you know?
And it's accepted. It's commonplace by Americans. Oh, well, they got arrested. Okay. Oh, they got killed. All right. You know, it's all been accepted for so long that it's a runaway train. And I hope that we somehow get a handle on it now and start realizing that protest is it's fundamental to democracy. You have to be able to have the people have a voice. We're supposed to have a voice in Congress. These are our representatives.
No, they call the cops on you when you show up. But Don, I think the thing now is we have a lot of people protesting. I mean, it's heartening. I was at the Women's March in Washington, D.C. I couldn't move. When they said it was a couple million and a half or something, I was like, my eye, it was. I've been at million-person marches. This was like 3 or 4 million.
They don't count.
Yeah,
that's another thing. Yeah. No critical counts of how many people show up. We're not allowed to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that from February 15th, 2003, you know, when we were in New York City, when they had the first really huge anti-war protests, you know, in anticipation of the invasion of Iraq. And I never saw anything that massive in my life. And I've been at this, you know, a long time also. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. And they discounted all of that. But
it was never even on the news.
So now the propaganda that's put out, because they're really afraid of shooting people now. I think because of people like Laurel who won't stop shaking that squirrel. And they should be. They should be afraid of shooting people. Now the propaganda is, oh, they're paid to be there. Those are paid protesters. Oh, who paid these people to come, you know? And so that's the new lie. The new lie to sell is those people aren't sincere. Those people aren't really angry that things are happening the way they're happening.
They're put up.
Yeah, and you know, if you weren't paying them, they wouldn't be there. You know, and that's the next lie that and all
who's
it really
the they?
Does.
Who is the they that pays them?
I don't know. I'd like to submit a voucher myself. meanwhile, you know, and then you have another effort like this Pepsi commercial.
Oh my God, wasn't that awful?
Yeah. Allison wrote about Allison. Laurel, maybe Allison wrote the channel through you.
She moved her fingers.
Laurel wrote about that at her blog at Mendocino Coast Current at WordPress.com. I want you to talk about that.
What needs to be read by everyone because she read that to me last night because I've been so busy and I was making dinner. And when she said the part about legislation to protect protesters, like I dropped everything, looked up. My husband started applauding. You know, this is real legislation that needs to be put forward and we need to start approaching people.
We need to protect ourselves is what we do and stand up for ourselves. And this is a very effective way to do it. Now, I've spoken to a few people since writing the article because we're getting some traction and interest. And it seems like a resolution might be an easier way for us to go through Congress and just have resolutions. And
it still needs to be proposed by someone, though. So we need to start targeting, bad word. We need to start finding someone who is willing to put that House resolution forward.
Problem is they got rid of so many people that were willing to do that because Cynthia McKinney, others.
Yeah, Conyers. I'm thinking maybe John Conyers would do it. Mm. But we do need some nice lefty.
Yeah.
Some nice human being.
But I think that there's also the possibility that, you know, if we somehow get this out there to the world and people start understanding that is their personal American right, civil rights. This is a civil society, which is not a concept that we talk about in America very much. And I learned about at the UN, civil society. society is society that doesn't include the government or corporations or any. It's just us. We need to be knocking on the door of our representatives and saying we want to be able to protest without getting killed. It's for our children. They're the ones that are going to face this.
Yeah, without all of it. I mean,
oh, of course. But I think if we take it to the nth and we talk about the killing part, I think that that's the most resonance, you know, and that has to be taken off the table. It has to be taken off the table.
There was no reason those weapons were loaded that day. If you go back to
why were they
May
even
4th,
doing
1970, they weren't supposed to have bullets in their guns.
Oh, but no, they're allowed to do that in two states, Mississippi and Ohio. How unusual that they had it at Jackson State and Kent State.
Wow.
That's but there's still the protocol, and it's guaranteed by our Constitution, is that our armed forces do not make war against the citizenry. If it had been policemen, it would have been one thing, because policemen are allowed to have armed weapons around the citizenry, but the army is not. And so I don't care what state says what, the Constitution's bigger, right? That's why they wrote it that way. And those two states weren't even in the United States when the Constitution was written, for God's sake. So, you know, they had bullets in their weapons. Why? Oh. That they weren't supposed to.
Well,
they had a message to deliver.
Yes, and so do you two today. So let's talk about, or tomorrow, let's talk about a little bit what you're heading into for Thursday for the commemoration.
Well, this is an interesting year because it's not just the 47th anniversary of the killings and shootings. It's also the 40th anniversary of the protests in 1977 to stop them from kind of obliterating the crime scene with this gymnasium. And so
they build a gymnasium on the edge of the shooting site. It changes the topography and the perception. It makes the guardsmen appear as if they were hemmed in.
Yeah, and they've planted trees that change it too. They've done a lot of things that change the look of where it happened.
Right.
I mean, one of the things you can do for yourself is go to the scene of the crime, and you go to Dealey Plaza, and you're like, there's nobody shooting from the school book depository. That's stupid. You know, if you can stand there and look at it. So you get to Kent State, you see what happened, but as Laurel said, you can't see because they've changed it. So the kids protested, but luckily there was a professor at Kent State in the day who wrote a timeline of what happened. And it went back about 12 years. So they started the plans for this gym 5 years before the kids were shot. And then they just went forward with the plan. And there was a dean of the school, the president of the college, who said, I am completely and totally against you putting this gym there now. And he personally was against the gym, said no, blah, blah, blah. The other people prevailed upon him to change his mind. And they didn't exactly say how they how they convinced him to change his mind. But he dropped his objections to building the gym there. But then he resigned. And after they got him to relent, he quit.
Mm.
So they got a new director, and they just kept steamrolling forward. Kids started finding out about it. And in 1975, it was decided that the gym would be built before the kids found out about it. And by 1977, when they found out about it and started protesting, and protesters came from all over the country to protest it, it was a fait accompli. You know, it was already happening.
Hmm.
And then when they said, well, you can turn it, or you can do this, or you can do that, you could turn the building, I'm thinking you can go up. Buildings can go up. You know, they said, oh, no, we already accepted a bid from a contractor. The second bid would get angry. I mean, they had these stupid reasons not to listen to decency, right. Human decency.
Right.
It's because they had an agenda, and this exposes the agenda. They need to control the narrative. They own the narrative. Only they will be able to contact it. And so I come in with another narrative. I'm not saying that's the only narrative. It's certainly not a conspiracy theory. But I come in and I'm called a conspiracy theorist, and I am blocked from participating. I'm an outsider. How am I an outsider? My sister died there. we work in the realm of truth, which is not the realm that they're coming from.
Yeah. Well, the truth is ugly, and their role in it certainly is ugly as well. I wish you both the best of luck, and we'll speak with you again afterwards. Maybe you can fill us in on what happens.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thanks, Don.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.